This round of our 3-minute fiction contest is now closed, and as we speak, our staff here at All Things Considered and the students from the famed Iowa Writers Workshop are pouring through your stories. We've received 3,000 stories this round, and in a few weeks, we'll announce the winner. But until then, we're posting some of our picks so far at our website, npr.org/3-minute-fiction. That's 3-minute-fiction, all one word, no spaces. And our judge, All Things Considered book reviewer and writer Alan Chews, is here in the studio with me to talk about some of those picks. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Guy.
You have a small pile of stories in your hand, recent submissions. What do you got for us, Alan?
I've got a story that seems to have nothing to do with the photograph. at least I can't figure it out.
Right. You were supposed to go to the website and look at a photograph and write a story inspired by it.
But this is, I think, a lovely piece of work. This is a story called It's Not Your Fault by Audrey Burns, who lives in Cincinnati. I'll read the beginning. Every other weekend, instead of sleeping in her own room under her green and yellow Marimekko bedspread with matching sheets, she had to sleep in her dad's waterbed with the smelly leopard print comforter and the personal items on his pine nightstand that he never bothered to hide, like his credit card statement showing a purchase at XXX Video, a canceled check for $4,200 made out to the Paradise Casino.
Well, I wonder where that story's going.
It's about a girl who is suffering through visits to her father, who is apparently not a very admirable guy.
Yeah, it sounds like a difficult one. What else do you have there, Alan?
This is a story. Well, it's actually not really a story. It's called Romanian Story. It's an anecdote. It could have been a wonderful story. It's very charming. It's by Roxana von Kraus, who lives in Boston. Here's the opening. It was still communist Romania then. We shared our small Bucharest apartment with cousins, aunts, and complete unknowns. Life as usual, and I was 7 years old. One Sunday morning, my father opened a world atlas and showed me the places he had traveled to. Here was Spain and the guns of Gibraltar, Morocco and Libya, Patagonia with her wild winds, Egypt, where Napoleon found the Rosetta Stone and the key to the language of the pyramids, Cyprus, given as a wedding present to Cleopatra, and Homer's world, from Turkey to Ulysses' Ithaca. I was mesmerized.
It's amazing that that story and the previous story you read seem to have nothing to do with that photograph. Obviously, we've just heard bits of it, and yes. I imagine that at some point they touch on it, but we're talking about a photograph that appears to be in a cafe or some kind of shop with an open newspaper on a table, and a lot of people have been writing about it as a coffee shop, but yes. It's amazing to hear how people have taken that photograph and taken these stories in a completely different direction.
The imagination has a geography all its own.
Indeed. All right. What else do you have there, Alan?
This is a story called Saturday, and it's written by Susan Ingram, who lives in Randallstown, Maryland. Here's the opening. Janet couldn't remember when she'd first realized she was invisible. She supposed it had started, well, maybe it had started before, but she first noticed it when she would look into someone's eyes, say a passerby in the street, or even someone in the hallway at work when she was pushing the mail cart from office to office. She'd always thought it was only human. What you did is part of a community, a part of society. When someone passes by, you look them in the eyes, smile, and say hi, or hello, or how's it going? Janet always did.
These are just absolutely amazing stories to hear. They're so short. They're under 600 words, and they just open a completely new world. You're just reading a few lines from each of them.
Yeah, that's almost a kind of fractal effect, isn't it? Or maybe like those old paper pills that you drop into a fishbowl,
right,
and the flowers or the undersea animals would blossom out of the paper.
And Alan, I know you've got many, many more stories to read over the coming weeks. I imagine you have your work cut out for you right now.
Yes, short story tsunami alert.
And we'll check back with you in a couple of weeks to find out who the winner is. And, of course, Alan, the winner of this round will appear on this program with you. They'll get an autographed copy of your book, To Catch the Lightning. Alan Chews, of course, is an author, All Things Considered book critic, and the judge for this round of 3-Minute Fiction. Alan, thanks so much for coming in.
See you soon, Guy.
And thanks to everyone who submitted a story this round.
Let's get a backstage look at last night's Oscar presentations. Without any doubt, the biggest winner was The Hurt Locker. Catherine Bigelow made history with her win for Best Director. And the Academy disproved those who expected it to divide two top honors between Bigelow's movie and Avatar. NPR's Madeline Del Barco reports.
It was presenter Barbara Streisand who ended the suspense, opening the long-awaited Best Director envelope.
Well, the time has come. Catherine Bigelow!
And just like that, Catherine Bigelow was the first woman to ever win an Oscar for directing. Her film also turned out to be the best picture of the year, The Hurt Locker, a suspense thriller about an American bomb squad in the Iraq War.
And I'd just like to dedicate this to the women and men in the military who risk their lives on a daily basis in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the world, and may they come home safe. Thank you.
Bigelow said her breathless thank yous and walked off stage as the orchestra began playing the song I Am Woman. But backstage, she didn't seem to want to focus on the first female director title.
I hope I'm the first of many. And of course, I'd love to just think of myself as a filmmaker. I long for the day when that modifier could be a moot point.
Bigelow also didn't answer many questions about the fact that she and her film beat out her ex-husband, James Cameron, and his 3D blockbuster, Avatar. In all, The Hurt Locker won 6 awards, including Best Original Screenplay by journalist Mark Bowell, who covered the war for Playboy magazine. Backstage, Bowell was asked about being sued by Master Sergeant Jeffrey Sarver for allegedly stealing his story for the film.
Jeff is a brave soldier, and a screenplay is a work of fiction, and it's not based on any one person's story.
This year's Best Original Song went to the theme from Crazy Heart.
And this ain't no place for the weary kind. This ain't no place to lose your mind.
The man who starred in Crazy Heart, Jeff Bridges, won the Leading Actor Oscar for his turn as a down-and-out country singer. He gave a loopy acceptance speech thanking his family.
Mom and Dad, yeah, look! Woo! Thank you, Mom and Dad, for turning me on to such a groovy profession.
Then Bridges carried his Oscar and a glass of champagne to talk to reporters, hinting that he may even start up his own band. He promised his award would not overshadow his image as the dude in The Big Lebowski.
No, I'm digging the dude. I love him.
In winning her Leading Actress Award, Sandra Bullock seemed almost blindsided.
Did I really earn this, or did I just wear you all down?
And she joked about having kissed acting legend Meryl Streep, who was one of her competitors last night. Backstage, Bullock acknowledged that until her role in The Blind Side, she was known more for her comedic characters.
I just want to keep working in every genre that I'm allowed to until I'm asked to not do it anymore.
Bullock says she originally turned down the role, and she thought it was pretty funny that she won her Best Acting Award the night after she won a Razzie Award for Worst Performance in All About Steve.
And they'll sit side by side in a nice little shelf somewhere. The Razzie may be on a different shelf lower.
Stand-up comedian Monique earned an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress for her very serious turn as an abusive mother in Precious, the film that won for Best Adapted Screenplay for Jeffrey Fletcher.
And I don't want you to sit there and judge me, Miss Weiss.
You shut up and you let him abuse your daughter.
I did not want him to abuse my daughter. I did not
but
want him to hurt her.
But you allowed him to hurt her.
I did not want him to do nothing to her. So those things that she told you I did to her, who else was going to love me? Who was going to make me feel good?
Backstage, Monique was asked if she could identify at all with her character. She responded with a question of her own.
Have you ever had a dark moment when you were unlovable? I'm asking you the question.
Yes.
Didn't you want somebody to love you through it?
Yes.
That was that scene for me. For as cruel as Mary Jones was, for the monster that she was, everybody, and I don't care who you are and what crime you've committed, everybody deserves to be loved even when they're unlovable.
By wearing a royal blue gown and a gardenia in her hair, Monique explained that she was honoring the first African-American woman to win an Oscar in 1940, Hattie McDaniel, for Gone with the Wind.
So for you, Miss Hattie McDaniel, I feel you all over me.
In winning his Supporting Actor Award for his role in the film Inglourious Basterds, Christoph Waltz thanked the man who inspired him, director Quentin Tarantino.
And Quentin, with his unorthodox methods of navigation, this fearless explorer, took this ship across and brought it in with flying colors. And that's why I'm here.
His was the only award that Inglourious Basterds won, despite being nominated for 8. The science fiction thriller District 9 had been nominated for 4, but didn't win any awards. And Avatar took home only 3 of the 9 awards for which it had been nominated. Avatar did get spoofed during the show. Ben Stiller came decked out as one of the blue creatures from the futuristic planet Pandora.
That means this seemed like a better idea in rehearsal.
This year, the Academy Awards producers had promised a shorter, more lively show with hosts Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin. But even at 3 hours and 37 minutes long, they had to wrap it up abruptly.
Congratulations. I'll take one of those. Here, you have one.
Get out here with us.
You have one. But I'll take this. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the show is so long that Avatar now takes place in the past.
Avatar may have only earned Oscars for cinematography, visual effects, and art direction, but it also made history, making more money at the box office than any other movie before it. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Hollywood.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Your heart's on the loose. You rode them sevens with nothing to lose. This ain't no place for the weary kind. You called all your shots. Shooting a ball at the corner truck stop.
For the past few months, we featured a series here on the program called The Net at 40. It's where we talk about the history and the culture of the Internet. 40 years since the first computer-to-computer communication. And we've talked about domain names and bulletin board systems, the creation of email, everything except for
the elephant in the room.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's back in the studio with us, one of our producers, Travis Larchuk. Travis, tell us what the elephant in the room is.
Sex.
I thought so. Is that my cue to make a parental warning?
Yes, and if my parents are listening, Mom, now would be a great time to pull out that three tenor CD, pop it in, maybe kick back for the next few minutes and
all
just
right.
Go away.
Hopefully she'll do that. All right, so sex on the Internet.
Right, so to understand how we got to where we are today, I called up this guy named Peter Ackworth. He founded this website, kink.com.
That sounds like it's going to be a not safe for work moment.
Well, it depends where you work, I guess. Anyway, it was back in the late 1990s, and Peter Ackworth was working on a PhD in finance at Columbia University. He was trying to figure out what to do with his life, and so he turned to the Internet.
All I could find that was of interest, to me at any rate, was pornography. I remember Yahoo, which was the biggest search engine at the time by far, used to publish a page which listed the top user search terms. And I remember some large number of search terms were sexually related.
And he had this eureka moment.
Hang on, he got his PhD in finance at Columbia University and he became an internet porn kingpin?
Well, he actually dropped out of Columbia because he realized this is where the money is. And he founded this website, kink.com, and basically turned it into this cutting-edge porn empire. And he even ended up developing his own in-house engineering department because the pace that technology was developing at just wasn't fast enough for him.
Well, what kind of technology?
Well, we'll get to that in a few minutes. But first, I know you buy a lot of stuff online.
Almost everything.
Well, the people who pioneered e-commerce were basically pornographers. And I called up this guy, Jonathan Cooper-Smith, who is not a pornographer. He is a technology historian and a professor at Texas A&M.
The first part of the web to make money was pornography.
And that's because back in the early days of the Internet, pornographers were first in line adopting new technology to do things like encrypt credit card information, basically making it safe to buy stuff online.
You have a lot of some of the tactics, concepts, and business strategies pioneered by the cyber sex world that then flowed into the regular online world. You know, for instance, creating these websites where you join for a fee. Also, the cyber sex industry has been very active in trying to reduce credit card fraud.
Kind of a public service.
And it's not just about commerce. They also played a big part in other innovations that we use every day. Just think back to the early days of the internet.
You had to have the hookup, you had to have the computer, had to have the willingness to experiment a fair amount. And the people who do this tend to be young men. And this also happens to be a prime audience for pornography.
So it's just like that song from that musical Avenue Q.
The internet is for porn.
Jackie!
The internet is for porn.
And the thing about this song is it's kind of true. Up until a few years ago, porn sites got the most hits of anything on the internet. And today, the biggest sites online, social networking sites like
Facebook,
a lot of the stuff that you can do on those sites helped make America Online number one back in the 90s. And specifically, I'm talking about private chat rooms.
One of the nicknames for AOL in the industry was the house that sex chat built.
And a lot of the video technology that we use today that lets us watch clips or stream live video, a lot of that started out
on porn sites.
Exactly. You remember Peter Ackworth, the kink.com guy?
How could I forget?
Well, a few years ago, his customers were saying they wanted to see live video in high definition.
So we put together our own technology essentially to be able to do so. You know, if you go to CNN or anywhere else on the web, the video you're going to see there is a significantly lower bandwidth than that.
So CNN is actually taking its cues from the adult entertainment industry?
I don't know about that, but I was talking to Peter Ackworth about where the adult industry is going next, and he was talking to me about, you know, Avatar, it's the number one movie, and there's all this at-home 3D technology coming out.
I can see where this is going, Travis. I doubt James Cameron had that in mind.
Well, maybe not, but it is possible, and we know who the early adopters will be.
Indeed. That's one of our producers, Travis Larchuk. Travis, thanks.
No problem, guy.
All right, now while Facebook may ask what's on your mind, imagine a website that asks what are you buying? That's our last word in business today. Blippi.com is a new website where you register your credit card number and every purchase you make with that card will be posted online. From member station KLW in San Francisco, Martina Castro has some of the buzz on Blippi.
This is more exciting than going through old receipts. It's going through new receipts.
The new startup makes good fodder for Stephen Colbert, but Blippi is no joke. The founders have $1.6 million in venture capital. Blippi co-founder Philip Kaplan says the business uses are obvious.
Businesses really like Blippi because it's kind of the ultimate in word-of-mouth marketing. I buy something and I tell all my friends about it.
Kaplan says getting used to it wasn't easy, even for him at first. But now it's no different than posting family photos on Facebook. And what he had for lunch really isn't such a big deal.
$19.70 at Szechuan Cafe.
He spent $407.45 at Banana Republic. Wow.
That's Ryan Kahlo, reading from Kaplan's Blippi account. Kahlo runs the Consumer Privacy Project at Stanford Center for Internet and Society. He says this isn't just good fun.
We're increasingly living in this society where our information is out there, and it's being used, but we don't quite know how and why.
Kahlo notes that Blippi's privacy policy reserves the right to use account information for marketing. The company won't go into the specifics of its business model, but it does point out you can use a different credit card if you want to keep certain purchases private. For NPR News, I'm Martina Castro in San Francisco.
All right, you can find Morning Edition on Twitter. We don't post our receipts, but we do give you information about the program and links to recommended reading and more. At Morning Edition or at NPR Inskeep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Thousands of people gathered yesterday in Selma, Alabama, to remember a day known as Bloody Sunday, 45 years ago. On March 7, 1965, state troopers armed with clubs and tear gas attacked civil rights demonstrators on Selma's Edmund Pettus Bridge. In Selma yesterday, about 10,000 people participated in a recreation of that march. Today, the Obama administration will mark the occasion a different way. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan will be in Selma today to make a major announcement. The Education Department is launching 38 investigations into possible civil rights violations by schools and colleges in over 30 states. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
There's a reason the U.S. Education Department chose to unveil its civil rights agenda on the anniversary of Bloody Sunday on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, to remind Americans how much has changed for the better and what the federal government has yet to do to protect children from discrimination.
Claudio, the Office for Civil Rights is back in business.
That's Ruslan Ali, Assistant Secretary in the Office for Civil Rights. Every year, she says, her office gets about 6,300 complaints, violations that include suspending and disciplining black children more often and more harshly than other children, ignoring the needs of non-English-speaking students, and denying students access to college preparatory and advanced placement programs, just to name a few. The results, says Ali, are tragic.
African-American students are six times less likely to be college and career ready in biology than their white counterparts, or four times less likely to be college ready in algebra. We see districts where only 3% of high school English language learners are performing at grade level in math and in English.
Ali says Latinos and blacks are also more likely to get the worst, least experienced teachers. Her task?
Conduct 38 investigations around 40 different issues under our jurisdiction.
School districts and states that have been targeted may not know for weeks who they are. Education Department officials want to carefully choreograph these investigations so that they're not perceived as lowering the boom without first reaching out to school officials and getting their cooperation. How the black community views these investigations is important, too. Many black parents no longer care if their children sit next to white children, as long as they get the same educational resources and opportunities. Latinos, on the other hand, pose a very different set of civil rights challenges. Tom Sines of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund says, in some states, Latinos can't even register for school without proof of their immigration status,
which has been unlawful since 1982 in a United States Supreme Court decision.
And yet, it happens all the time, says Science. As for the desegregation of schools, Science agrees. Like most black parents, Latinos just want good teachers and safe neighborhood schools, where their children at least have a shot at catching up with their white peers.
The achievement gap is the number one civil rights issue. It's more important than integration.
That may very well be true, but Education Department lawyers say the achievement gap is the result of an opportunity gap. And that is what the department's investigations are going to tackle more vigorously than ever. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
The NCAA men's basketball tournament field will not be officially announced until this Sunday, but the first five invitations were sent out over the weekend as conference tournament play began. As always, some of the intriguing stories involve smaller schools dreaming big. Commentator John Feinstein joins us now to discuss some of them. Hi, John.
Good morning, Steve.
So let's start with a conference champion that did not have to win a conference tournament to qualify, as so many of them do. That team comes from Cornell.
Yeah, the Ivy League is the only one of the 31 conferences that does not have a conference tournament. The Ivy League is unique that way. And Cornell won the conference title for the third straight year, which is remarkable, Steve, when you think about the fact that Princeton and Penn have so dominated the Ivy League since it was formed back in the 1950s. But Cornell has only four losses this year. Two of them are to Syracuse and Kansas, who are currently ranked 1 and 3 in the country. That's how good they've been. And they're going to go into the tournament as, I think, something like a number 9 or a number 10 seed and one of those small schools that no big-name school is going to want to face in the first round.
Yeah, and with a real chance to win at least one game, it would seem.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, because they've played such good teams this year, they're not going to be intimidated by anybody they play. They have five seniors who start, eight seniors on the team. By the way, they all live together in the same house, so they're the definition of a close team. And they'll walk on the court a week from Thursday or Friday absolutely convinced that they're going to win that game.
Why is it, by the way, John, that the Ivy League doesn't have a conference tournament?
Partly because the Ivy League just likes to be different. It's why they don't let their football champion play in postseason play, and also because they say that the players will miss too much class, which frankly is ridiculous. If you played a three-day tournament on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, it would be the same as any normal Ivy League weekend, except the two finalists would play on Sunday instead of just on Friday and Saturday.
Nevertheless, as you say, they are the Ivy League.
They are the Ivy League, all caps.
What about the other four teams that have qualified here?
Well, there are a bunch of interesting stories. Northern Iowa is another team with a lot of seniors that is in the tournament for the third straight year. They won their conference over the weekend in Missouri Valley. The Missouri Valley, you might remember a few years ago, Steve, had two teams reach the Sweet 16. So they're going to be a threat. Winthrop, little school in Rock Hill, South Carolina. This is the ninth time in 12 years they've been in the NCAA tournament. They upset the top seed Coastal Carolina, and they're a team that beat Notre Dame a couple years ago. So those are certainly teams you want to look at when you start making your brackets out a week from today.
Now, one of the reasons that we're talking to you on this Monday morning, John Feinstein, is, of course, because we're going to learn more and more about the NCAA tournament field over the next several days as these conference tournaments unfold. Who are you looking at?
Well, again, we are starting to see the big conference tournaments tomorrow, the Big East, with their five-day extravaganza in New York, because they have 16 teams, Steve. Think about it. Half the teams in the league, because they have to start play on Tuesday, would have to win five games to win the Big East. It takes six to win the national championship. That's not a conference. That's a confederacy. I would hate to be one of those lower-seeded teams in the Big East. That's a lot of basketball to have to play. One other team worth watching, I think, is a team that's been important in the past but not recently, Temple, where Fran Dunphy came from the Ivy League, Pennsylvania, 4 years ago, has completely rebuilt the program. They've won the Atlantic 10 regular season, and I think they'll be a 3 or 4 seed in the tournament going in. A great story because Philly's such a great basketball city.
And in a few seconds, would you name one team that you think might go a lot farther than expected?
I'll pick Siena again because they won first-round games in the last 2 years and they dominated their conference once again this year. Very good coach in Fran McCaffrey.
John, always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks, Steve.
Comments from John Feinstein, author of Last Shot, a Final Four Mystery.